Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 5th, 2002. Today's session is titled, Christians in the Wilderness, Cultivating a Garden. Our presenter is Deanne Lagerquist. Let's listen in.
Timeline, it's the historian in me. I always want you to be able to get things in chronological relationship to each other. I tell my students, most of the time, I don't care very much about the date, but you do need to know what came first and what came later. So I'll refer to that a little bit. Okay. So just a little review about this biblical motif. The notion of wilderness as it's used in Christian thought comes from a very specific instance that has a specific location in time and place. And then we move out of that into various interpretations. And in the Bible study this week, we've been talking about this, particularly through the book of Numbers. So what I have here is a little chart that first shows what I call the paradigmatic example of the motif of wilderness. And that starts with, here we go, the Hebrews, right? Who and when? The Hebrews, in that time between the patriarchal period with Abraham, again, just a little chronology here, I tell my students, think of Abraham as the father of his nation, and George Washington as the father of your nation, and so you can put Abraham about 1700 BC. There's a lot of dispute. We have hundreds of years in our, you know, was it 16, was it 18, depends on who you read. But if you think of Abraham and Washington as roughly the same distance from zero in opposite directions, and David about 1,000, this comes in between. So the Hebrews, what do they encounter, the where, what is the geophysical landscape? It's a desert. That's what they're out in, is the desert, probably the Sinai Peninsula. And in their way of thinking, this desolate desert, equal, what it is not cultivated, not fertile. So remember, those of you who are here, remember we talked about how in the Hebrew lexicon, the desert, which is brown and without water, is cursed. And the green places where there's water and cultivation and fig trees and olive trees and grass for the livestock so you can have milk and flowers so you can have bees, so you can have honey, right? We have this refrain over and over. The promised land, the land of milk and honey. And it doesn't resonate with Americans in quite the same way, although I have to say I've been traveled in Greece and eaten Greek yogurt and Greek honey. It became a much more vivid image to me. Okay, so the Hebrew people in this kind of place, what happens to them out there in the desert? Three kinds of experiences. First, it's escape from Egypt. The wilderness, the desert, and I'll say something about whether those are actually synonymous terms, in this paradigmatic case is liminal. It's between two other things. It's a threshold experience. And for the Hebrews, it's between the captivity of Egypt and that promised land where there's water and milk and honey and figs and pomegranates and grapes and the sorts of things that the desert monks, we talked about last time, imagined would be their food in paradise. Then the second thing is out there in that between place, it's a place of temptation. So it's dangerous physically. In the desert, there's no water. In the desert, you can easily die, right? But it's also spiritually dangerous. And we see that vividly in the story of the golden calf. Then the third thing, it's also the place where they get the law and the covenant. So It's more than one thing from the very beginning, but the motif of wilderness is very ambiguous. And then drawing on the work of George Williams, these four interpretations or meanings that we find in the Old Testament, that the wilderness is a moral wasteland, but a potential paradise. The wilderness is a place of temptation, it's a place of covenantal bliss, and it can be a place of refuge and renewal. It can mean more than one thing. And we find it meaning more than one thing in the biblical witness as well. So I talked about Hosea and the prophetic use of this, emphasizing covenantal bliss, saying to the people of Israel, remember when you were in the wilderness, and comparing it to the time of betrothal. But he also cautions them that if they don't return to the Lord, that they're going to be in a wasteland and there will be no fertility. And then he promises that there will be a renewal of that and things will be green and bear fruit again. So we see that in the biblical material. Now, I want to say something about this word, wilderness and desert, just to remind you that it comes from an English root. And it means essentially where the wild animals live. It comes into the biblical text in English when the Bible is translated into English in the 1500s. Okay? So that the English translators, when they think desolation, when they think where is a place that's dangerous, that's frightening, they don't have experience of desert. Right? So they use this word wilderness, which in their experience is the woods, the forest, to refer to the desert. Okay? And that's, you may think, oh, picky, 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 but it makes a difference in your experience. And we'll see that particularly in the American setting. Okay, so last time we talked about, very quickly to review, the Egyptian hermits who by 400, there are thousands of these Christians, men and women, who have withdrawn from the city, which they have come to see as a sort of captivity, the easy life, right, that turns you away from the word of God, that begins to feed you, make you think that you have what you need, but really you need to turn to the word of God to eat the manna of God's word, and particularly because of the change of legal status in the church. Right, so they begin to think the established church in the city has become captive. So like the Hebrews went out of Egypt to get free into the wilderness, so these hermits go out of the city into Egypt, into the wilderness. Okay, so the Egyptian hermits go into the desert, which is not the city, and the city should not be understood as paradise. They go into the desert where the natural limitations of the desert become their discipline. You could say they're the disciples of the wilderness. They learn from the wilderness, from the lack of lush food. They learn to turn their cravings and their longings for God. It's a famous book about medieval monasticism called The Love of Learning and the Desire for God. And that's really what they're trying to do out there, to turn their desire to God. So they are picking up. They know that there's temptation. It's dangerous in that way as well as physically, but they also think it will be for them a refuge, a place of renewal. And they're not out there to make the desert into paradise. They have no illusions about that. Yeah.
I'm having trouble understanding why is the wilderness a temptation? Because I think of temptation, maybe it's my limitation of seeing temptation as luxury.
Right. Well, for the monks, it's very easy to describe this for the monks. And they're astute psychologically, right? So you get out there and you know if you are deprived. They have dreams about things like cheese and grapes, right? They've left things behind. They have these dreams, and they talk about that as demons.
Okay.
So the temptation is that I'll run away.
Oh.
Right? Or the temptation is, I read a story last time about someone who had set up a garden, and we'll go to the garden and we'll begin to think this is paradise. Yeah.
because the lack creates a
desire, and the desire can be misdirected. Right. And I think also you can begin in the paradigmatic case of the Hebrews. They can't look forward,
right.
And they think they're stuck. So they begin to not. The food images are very potent here. Instead of waiting for the pomegranates and the milk and the honey, they begin to long for the leeks and the garlic and
right.
the fish.
Right.
Not that leeks and garlic and fish are anything to sneeze at, but you know, you do see the difference in the kinds of food that they're anticipating. Okay. So with that, let's turn then to the American context. And let me give you a summary. What we see here is from, you could say, from fear to use to appreciation. From fear of the wilderness to use of the wilderness to appreciation of the wilderness. Okay, so very different things. But now, having laid that out so neatly, boom, 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 I got to tell you, it's never like that. When I'm studying with students about gender roles and gender expectations, I tell them it's like sedimentary rock. Here are my expectations. Here are my parents' expectations. Here are my grandparents' expectations. You know, they're all there. And sometimes there's a little bit of an earthquake and they, you know, and then the old ones are poking at me. And this happens also with American notions about wilderness or about nature. Sometimes we use that term and that signals a shift because wilderness is where beasts that are uncontrollable live, right? And nature, it already has a nicer pastoral kind of tone, right? So I'm going to lay these out as if they go like this, from the howling wilderness to the kind of cultivation of a garden that we can see out on the prairie to the notion of the sublime, as if it just went in a straight line, but they're all flowing together. Okay. So, first I'm going to talk about the Puritans. Oh, and I should say, because I came to teach sort of at the last minute, I haven't ordered these books, but if this is stuff you're interested in, two books I'd recommend to you are Belden Lane's classic book, Landscapes of this... No, that's not right. Robert Nash's classic book, Wilderness in the American Mind. This came out in the early 60s, but it's been updated, so if you're going to buy it, you really want, or even from the library, the fourth edition, because he's reworked some chapters and added material so that it's not stuck in the 60s. He's really influenced in his portrayal of Christianity by the famous Lynn White essay that Paul Santamaryer talked about, so you want to read it with a touch of disbelief, you know, it's all negative view from Christianity. And then a very different kind of approach is Belden Lane's book, Landscapes of the Sacred. I'm going to especially use that book tomorrow. And again, there's an expanded edition, which has additional chapters, which makes it a much better book than it was originally.
Is that a different book than the one you mentioned
earlier? That's the same one I think I mentioned.
Sacred Space.
It's about sacred space. I couldn't remember the exact title.
All right. That's
and today I have
know.
The real title.
That's what I want
it's,
to know.
It's called Landscapes of the Sacred, Geography and Narrative in American Spirituality.
Okay.
And it's some theoretical chapters and some case study chapters, and it's very readable. Okay, so let's turn to the Puritans. We all learned in elementary school about the Puritans and the Pilgrims and how they are coming, what the standard story is, they're coming to America for religious freedom, right? And then you get the revisionist story that they're coming to America for their religious freedom, right? That they're not coming for everybody's religious freedom, but their own. What's important for our purposes about that story is that they really understand themselves to be in a fundamental but not a detailed way, the descendants of these hermits who withdraw from the corrupted church. Okay? Now, they're not going out into the desert with sand, and they're not going out and living by themselves, right? Instead, they're going to form holy commonwealths. They're going to form communities, which the tradition of Pacoimus in Egypt and Benedict in Europe and Basil in Asia Minor, there is that tradition. But they aren't forming monasteries. They're not celibate. So the details are different, but the impulse is the same. To withdraw from the corrupted church, to withdraw from what they see as the paradisical pretensions of the Reformed Church. I went once, my husband's family lives in northeastern Indiana, it's a big Mennonite Amish community there, and there's a museum there of Anabaptist history, and so I thought, well, this is really good, I should do this. So I'm going through this museum of Anabaptist history. It was quite revelatory to me how they portrayed Luther. Well, he was good as far as he went, but he sure stopped too soon, right? Okay? And that's their view. So, they leave England, they come over on those boats, and what they find is not a desert. It's a forest, right? It's the woodlands of New England. And it's easy to get lost there. There's water, so you're not going to be parched, but it's easy to get lost. And there are wild animals there. And moreover, there are wild people there. That's their view, right? So they see a kind of savagery, a kind of frightening landscape, which is peopled and inhabited by both human beings who they see as having given in to the evils of human nature, and all those animals. Now, I have to say that even in this tradition, there's variety, and people like Roger Williams and John Eliot, who worked with natives, had a different view. And sometimes they would say, oh, here are these native people who are naturally more moral than we are, you know, and maybe they're the 12 lost tribes of Israel, the 10 lost tribes of Israel, so there's some variety among the Puritans, and I'm just giving you the broad strokes, okay? This view, where they regarded it as the howling wilderness, is really informed by Calvinism. So if we want to understand how this biblical motif is being appropriated, we have to think about who, where are they, what's happening to them, and what intellectual resources do they bring to bear. The Puritans certainly have this biblical tradition, and they were very given to typological interpretation. That means you read the Bible and you say, the Hebrew people are a type, and we're the same type, so we follow the same pattern that the Hebrew people did. They also, in Calvinism, had a view of human nature which includes total depravity. So in their vocabulary, nature, to do what comes naturally, is to give in to sin, right? That's very, very important. So if you go out into the wilderness, the forest, and you become like the forest, what you've done is given in to sin. You have become wild. You haven't returned to the Garden of Paradise. You're outside the gates of Eden. That's very important for how they think about this. And they organized their villages with that in mind. So here is a little map. I should erase those red squares, maybe. A little map, which is based on a treatise from the 1630s about town planning. How should you organize your town? If you live in the covenant, remember, covenantal bliss is one of the ways of thinking about how you live in the wilderness. They didn't come to America to make paradise. They're going to live in the wilderness as the covenant people of God. How do they organize their lives? Remember in the beginning of Numbers, the instructions about how to organize with the Ark of the Covenant is in the middle, and then the people around. Well, so too here. In the middle, the meeting house. And the village green, the school, the store, the inn. That's in the middle. If you come out of the history of religions, and Belden Lane does more of this, there's a school of thought that comes from Mircea Eliade that emphasizes sacred space often is organized around, because it axis mundi, the axis of the world. If you've been to Delphi in Greece, it's the navel of the world, right? It's the center of the world. Well, so too here. The meeting house is the center. And then the houses are in the second ring around. Proximity to the meeting house is a physical manifestation of what they call owning the covenant. So people who are rightly related to God live in the center. Where, and in fact, there was a law in the subsequent decades that in Massachusetts that when you made a new settlement, none of the houses could be more than half a mile from the meeting house. Now, that law, like this plan, is honored more in the breach than in reality, but the ideal is a powerful ideal nonetheless. Okay? So then the third one is the common fields, where you have the livestock, the not wild animals, the domesticated animals, right? The animals you can control. And then there were these, in the fourth ring, these big 400-acre lots that were for great men. And I don't quite understand what's going on with that. Then in the fifth ring, freestanding farms with crops. Again, plants that you control. Not wild plants, but plants that you control. Plants that feed you. And then the sixth concentric circle are the swamps and the rubbish ground. Now just think about Holden. There's the village center, and then the houses. And we don't have any animals, domesticated animals. Ours is pretty permeable, right? Because the deer come in, right? But the rubbish ground is on the outside, Garbo Dock, and then it goes out. We do this kind of unconsciously. And then beyond these six concentric circles, which are about 6 square miles, is what Belden Lane, this is Belden Lane's vocabulary, he describes it as an area of bewilderment and disorientation in the dark forest, the home of malevolent forces, the landscape of fear. So how did the Puritans think about wilderness? One of the ways they thought about wilderness is it's a frightening place. We've come into it, like the Hebrew people went into it, not to dwell there, but to be there long enough to develop our holy community that will be a city on a hill, that will be an example to the rest of the church. And they organized their space that way. So that was their intention. They were not like the hermits in that they didn't go out there to learn from the limits. They weren't disciples of the wilderness. They kind of wanted to keep it out there beyond the swamps and rubbish grounds. Now, that sounds nice and tidy. Very nice and tidy. And of course, it's influenced, the other thing I should say, it's influenced not just by their Calvinism, but by the fact that they really were in a struggle for survival. You know, that the Plymouth colony lost over half the people in the first winter. So the notion that the wilderness is dangerous is not just in their heads. Right. Oh, and the one thing I didn't point out that brings me to is right here. Look what's in the very center, the graveyard. So there's this little bit of chaos that's in the middle.
This may be, you know, at the wrong level, but so why is the story of the Native Americans saving the Plymouth colony the preeminent story that comes forward from that period? I mean, at least in popular culture.
Well, it's in contemporary popular culture. And I think it has to do with what happens here with Romanticism.
Okay, so that was...
But of course, one of the things they do want, they have a little bit of wanting to save the wilderness. So the natives who come forward are also the beginnings of the praying Indians. So it's a complicated interrelationship. Okay. Now, and that actually that's a good question because I've now made it very tidy, but the truth is there's tension in this motif. There's a lot of tension in it. And one of the places we see this tension between wilderness and paradise is also in the biblical narrative of the tension between journey and arrival. And do these people understand themselves as on a journey, or have they arrived in the promised land? Especially in the second and third generations, this becomes harder to think about this as transitional, right? Because I don't remember coming on the boat, right? I didn't have that. And some people work the motif that way, that coming across the Atlantic is the wilderness part, and now we're in the promised land. And if this is the promised land, then the temptation to think it's paradise is stronger, right? It's much stronger. We have this same dynamic at Holden, right? Are we in the wilderness? Is this a time of transition? Or, you know, is it a place you're supposed to leave? That journey or arrival business. When you come into that generation here, I have Jonathan Edwards. Jonathan Edwards is a fascinating case in this regard. Fascinating, because Jonathan Edwards, despite what we learn, if all you ever read of Jonathan Edwards is Sinner in the Hands of an Angry God, you have been misled, because this gives you the grimmest view. Jonathan Edwards loved the beauty of the world, and the religious affections, and the sensate. This was very important in his view of religion. And so he had some appreciation for the awesome quality of the beauty of the wilderness. What he tended to do was to interiorize. The wilderness is inside me. And so the human nature, that this howling wilderness is less around me than inside me, okay? And he also was very clear that it was impossible to make this holy commonwealth, that the reign of God is later, okay? That tension is also, it shows up in like Hawthorne, in The Scarlet Letter and in his short stories. You see both the wilderness as a dangerous place, as a wasteland, and also the temptation of the wilderness as a place of freedom, right? I don't know how recently you've read The Scarlet Letter. I taught it last fall and read it for a really long time, but my teaching partner from the English department said, we absolutely have to read The Scarlet Letter. And I said, okay. Well, and it's there. I mean, it's so powerful that Hester goes and lives kind of out past the swamps and the rubbish. Right, she lives out on the beach, close to the water. And Hester is this tension is right in her. How the allure of getting away from the conventions. And yet finally she's overcome by that. So that's in there too. By the 1700s, so here that's Jonathan Edwards, what we began to see and another interesting literary phenomenon is captivity narratives. So Mary Rowlandson is one of the first ones about the children of the settlers and the examples of people who are captive by natives. And Mary Rowlandson's first-person narrative, again, it's just palpable that she starts out thinking, well, these are savages, these are terrible people, and yet she finds that sometimes they're good. Right? And that she has certain agency, even as a captive, that she didn't have in her own land. So there begins to be an allure of the wilderness, that maybe there's something good about the wilderness. And it's not the wilderness's limits, but it's the openness of the wilderness. So you see how the motif is shifting
Right. It's not that the wilderness is small and desert-like, because it's a different wilderness. Going out into the desert is limiting. Going out into the woodlands of New England can be scary, but you're not going to die from nothing to eat. Different experience, different interpretation. As we come into the 1700s and the 1800s, of course, a really important thing that happens is the westward movement and the pioneers. This takes them into different landscapes, but it carries forward a notion that what you do with wilderness is cultivate it. You make it useful. You tame it. You make it into a garden. That's very much on the minds of the pioneers. Again, it's a complicated thing, and particularly feminist scholars have offered some critiques of this broad generalization. I want to give you examples of two different ways of looking at this from Ole Rolbach's Giants in the Earth. Now remember, Giants in the Earth is in South Dakota. It's a very different landscape. It's not a desert. It's not a forest. It's long, it's high grass prairie. And how many of you have read this book, Giants in the Earth? So you kind of know the story about these Norwegian immigrants who go out there to settle. And people who know very little about this book, one of the things they know is that Barrett, the main female character, goes nuts. Okay? Partly she goes nuts because there are no limits. There are no boundaries. Now, I got to tell you, I grew up in Iowa. When I started coming to Holden, I had the exact opposite experience. I felt so claustrophobic. I had to bring with me a poster of a prairie landscape and put it up in our chalet. I would go in there at night and I'd go, so that I wouldn't be crazy. And so it gave me an enormous appreciation for Barrett, who was having the opposite experience. Now, Barrett, there are two incidents in this book. One that I want to refer to. One is when her husband, Per Hansa, destroys surveying stakes. He finds on the land that his neighbors, his Norwegian neighbors, have staked out for their cultivation stakes that some Irish have put there. And he pulls them up and he destroys them. And Barrett finds the stakes before he destroys them. And she begins to worry about this and to try and understand what's going on. And this is what Rolbach writes. The explanation was plain. This desolation out here called forth all that was evil in human nature. Land fully as good as theirs extended round about them for thousands of miles. But these people had come and had immediately wanted to seize the land what had already been taken, thinking that it would be an easy matter since they were the stronger. Then her own husband had used deceit and force to drive them away, and now all was well. What would become of the children who had to grow up in such an atmosphere? Their own children. She listened to her boys gloating over the incidents of the recent encounter, and her soul shuddered. No, she knew one who would not endure it forever out here. And the next incident, it comes in the next chapter, has to do with food again. Per Hansa has gone into town to buy supplies, and the neighbor kills an animal and skins it and chops it up and distributes it to this little settlement. Her sons bring it home, and she cooks it. It's been an awful day. The children are at each other. They're picking at each other, they're picking fights. Finally, she comes to the point where she takes a stick and whacks one of the boys across his neck so he gets a big welt. They won't do what they're supposed to. They're supposed to bring in the wood for her, and she finally has to go and get it herself, and that makes them feel ashamed. So you get this sense of wildness taking over, lack of order. She cooks the meal, they sit down to eat it, and one of the boys says, "It tastes like dog to me." To Store Hansa, it seemed a shameful thing for Ole to speak that way of the food which their mother had prepared for them. He swallowed spoonful after spoonful while sweat poured from him. I've heard it many times, the mother went on quietly, that bear meat is all right. The stew, they said, this was bear, was given as bear meat. The stew has a tangy taste, I noticed, but not so bad that it can't be eaten. You better leave the meat if you don't like it. It isn't bear at all, Ole Bo blurted out. What? Cried the mother in alarm, lowering her spoon. It's only a lousy old badger. I've heard Dad say often they aren't fit to eat. It's true, every word, cried Storhanza, suddenly feeling frightened and jamming his spoon further down into the crack. I could tell by its tail. Siebert had forgotten to cut it off. Oh, I'm going to be sick. I didn't feel it coming. Barrett got up, trembling in every limb. She took the bowl and carried it out into the darkness. A long way from the house, she emptied it on the ground. The baby cried and toddled after her. The boys sat at the table, glaring reproachfully at each other. In the eyes of both blazed the same accusation. A fine mess you've made of things. Why didn't you keep your mouth shut? The mother came in again. She set the empty kettle on the stove and scoured it out carefully. Then she cooked porridge for them. But when it was ready, she would eat nothing herself. That night, she hung still more clothes over the window than she had the evening before. She sat up very late until she seemed unable to go to bed. She'd been lying awake a long time. Sleep would not come. Her thoughts drifted. So it had come to this. They were no longer ashamed to eat troll food. They had even sent it from house to house as lordly fare. Okay, so she's experiencing the wilderness. What happens? There are no limits. We do things that are forbidden. We eat food that's for trolls. And she covers up the windows at night to try and keep the dark out. Now, in contrast, she's sort of carrying through with this Calvinist view, right? The human nature has this wild ugliness in it, and the landscape can draw it out. Her husband, in contrast, has the cultivating a garden. How could he steal the time to rest these days? Was he not the owner of 160 acres of the best land in the world? Wasn't his title to it becoming more firmly established with every day that passed? And every new broken furrow that turned, he gazed at his sight and laughed happily, as if some pleasant and amusing spectacle. Such soil, only to sink the plow into it, to turn it over, to sod, and there was the field ready for seeding. And this was not just ordinary soil, fit for barley and oats and potatoes and hay and that sort of thing. Indeed, it had been meant for much finer and daintier uses. It was the soil for wheat, the king of all grains. Such soil had been especially created by the good Lord to bear this noble seed, and here was Per Hansa walking around on 160 acres of it, all his own. And he goes on to think about how he's going to get a second and a third and fourth and what he's going to have. And he says, the livestock, for instance, in the course of time, he would have great numbers, horses and pigs and cattle and chickens and ducks and geese, animals both big and small of every kind, and there would be quacking and grunting and mooing and neighing from every nook and corner of the farm. The place would need plenty of life for his Barrett to mother, but best to him of all and most delectable was the thought of the royal mansion which he had already erected in his mind, right? So this very different view of what's the wilderness. Is the wilderness a terrifying place that you should be protected from, you should run away from? Or is the wilderness just waiting for you to cultivate a garden, right? Now, is that garden the Eden? Is it going back in time to Eden? Or is it going forward in time? Are you going to make your own paradise? That's in the pioneer experience. The primary, you talk about our popular notion, the primary notion of the pioneers is that we cultivate a garden, right? And that we conquer the wilderness. There's lots of military metaphors there about conquering the wilderness and making it into farmland. A wonderful conflict, remember, in Oklahoma about the cattlemen and the farmers. But finally, the farmers win. By the 1890s, the wilderness is closed. You maybe remember this from your high school American history class, Frederick Jackson Turner writes about that in a famous essay on the closing of the American frontier and the importance of the frontier. So we went, Lewis and Clark were coming up on the centennial, 1802, in 100 years from charting what's out there to closing the wilderness. And Turner is one, now we begin to make a transition from the wilderness as either frightening or to be conquered to this sort of, toward preservation, a much more positive view of the wilderness. Turner helps in that because he links the frontier to what Nash calls sacred American virtues. So we begin to see that what the wilderness does is not make you savage, but it brings out all the best in you, right? It makes you strong and courageous and vital, and often it's masculine words, like virility, to be vital. It's a masculine word. The Boy Scouts start during this time period. This is the time period of Theodore Roosevelt, right? All, and we began to have this different view of how important wilderness is to American character. Now we need to back up in time, back to the Revolutionary era, and the time of deism. Now Santamaria talked about this yesterday, the view of God in deism is sometimes described as the watchmaker God. The other thing that happens in deism is that nature, wilderness, that had seemed frightening, in part because of what's going on in among naturalists, the sorts of things Lewis and Clark were doing with their instruments, measuring the stars, right, figuring out how the animals work, you know, all of that stuff, that nature ceases to seem chaotic and becomes ordered and patterned, right? And the God of the deists, or God as the deists understand God, is a God of order who has put the laws into nature. And so then we begin to read in the other direction, from nature to God. And both are orderly and neutral, if not beneficent, but certainly not frightening. Now, Nash makes this really fast transition, and I'm a little nervous about it, but from this deism, which makes nature neutral, to romanticism. People like Thoreau, who see nature as wonderful, as something that gives us access to what we didn't already have. The other place we see that is in landscape painting of the time. You have Edward Hicks. You all know these paintings, right? The Peaceful Kingdom, right? This is back to paradise. We saw it in the Desert Fathers, the story about the hyena. How do we get back to paradise? One of the signs will be that what was broken will be repaired. The relationship between humans and other animals will be repaired. That's one view of what's going on that makes it more positive. The other is in the work of Thomas Cole, and this is more in line with the romantics. Now, unfortunately, this reproduction doesn't really let you see. Here's wild, right, on this side, and here's cultivated. And what, because the reproduction is small, you can't quite see. It looks desert-like, but what it really is fields and little houses. So Cole has both of these. And this part, people begin to talk about as the sublime. That wilderness gives you access into the sublime, to the transcendent. And so romanticism, and man, is this broad strokes American intellectual history, but okay.
What's the years we're talking about?
These guys both lived, both of these painters died in the 1840s. Okay? And Thoreau, of course, is really pre-Civil War. So that's beginning to emerge. And you know where it's emerging is not on the edge of the frontier. It's emerging in New England. Now, what's the experience? Paul talked about this a little bit. Thoreau's experience of the wilderness is going to Walden Pond. How many of you have been to Walden Pond? You can walk there from downtown Concord. If you go there in the summer now, you see with little baby buggies out there to go swimming. And he could see the railroad from there, right? So my students, I mean, they see through this right away, especially the girls. They're like, he's taking his laundry home? What's this solitude business? Your view of wilderness can change when you're not afraid anymore, right? I don't think we need to make fun of him. It's easy to make fun of him. It's a cheap shot. Of course, what are we doing up here? We're not afraid. We got a hot shower. You know, maybe you don't get to flush as much as at home, but you can have a shower. No, I try to take one every other day so I can have a long one. But I got a hot shower. And so I can appreciate the wilderness in a way that John Holden couldn't. And that's where that comes from. Yeah.
I just want to go on record and say I haven't had a hot shower yet.
Oh, neither. Oh, no. Which place are you living in?
Lodge 2.
Oh, two.
Lodge 2 has no hot water?
I heard they were
short
of water.
Lodge 1 either.
You have to really learn how to use the
And Rick might give you an example.
The valve does not have a stop on it.
Right.
You could turn it around 25.
Okay, well, maybe Rick, you could do a little seminar after class about how to
work the valve. Important. You got to work it together.
So we have this thing going on simultaneous to the pioneers who see the wilderness as having utility value. That's what Parahansa has, utility value. The prairie is good because I can build a farm, because I can grow wheat, the best of all grains, right? That's what's good about it. And this sort of romantic thing. Now, what's really interesting is you see, way before I would have thought, Yosemite becoming a state preserve in the 1860s, the first movements for Yellowstone in the 1870s, the Adirondack State Forest Preserve in the 1880s.
Another one you should put up there is Frederick Olmsted.
It's right here.
Oh, okay. I can't see.
You're like the star student, always wanted to come to the next point.
It's our eyesight.
It's our eyesight, I guess.
No, okay.
If it was a little bit taller.
But what I want to say about these three, Yosemite, Yellowstone, and the Adirondack, is what is the logic for setting these aside? In a way, Yellowstone is easy to give the first one. Initially, they were going to make little islands around the curiosities and ornaments. That's the language of the time. So we'll make a little island around Old Faithful and a little island around something else. Then someone got the idea that maybe a good idea to make the whole thing. But why would you go there? Because sort of like, you know, it's almost like, when we were driving across to come out here, I started to say to myself, well, maybe one year you can take all photographs of large animals made out of cement, you know? But the language sounds sort of the same. Oh, let's go see that geyser. It wasn't wilderness as wild or wilderness as utility, but it was wilderness as curiosity and ornament of beauty. In the Adirondack case, there was a utility value to the preserve of the forest because of the watershed. So this moves us toward conservation, and I'm going to come back to that, but I want to do Olmsted. I think Olmsted is supposed to be next here. And that's, I think, coming out of a different understanding of the utility of that, which is that you see, like Turner, that contact with the wild is valuable to us aesthetically and morally. And Olmsted is an important landscape architect, one of the earliest landscape architects. So Central Park. Now Central Park, before Olmsted made Central Park, was flat. There was nothing there. All the hills, maybe that's an exaggeration. Most of the hills. The current landscape of Central Park is all artificial. I was just in Berkeley, you know. The Cal Berkeley campus is a gorgeous example of this notion that wilderness, there's something between terrifying wilderness and the city. It's not exactly rural, but it's manipulated nature. So I sat in the faculty club every day at this seminar and looked out the window, and there's a little brook, you know, and it's a little glade, and I, you know, I could have been at Holden when I was inside that building. And then a block over, it's Telegraph Avenue. You know, it's amazing. The other thing that's going on at the same time with this park movement is this cemetery movement. So we go from graveyards, which are chaotic, even if you have it in the middle of the green, to cemeteries, which Olmsted is involved in this too, laying them out. They're beautiful, they're sublime, they have lovely roads you can come and walk on, you can bring a picnic and sit with grandma, right? Yeah. In fact, we had cemeteries before we had parks in the U.S. So again, this transvaluation of not quite wildness. It's no longer where the wild things live, like that little kid's book, it's being changed. Now, that goes with the conservation movement. Oh, if Muir up here as well. All it's an interesting clump of people here. Olmsted, John Muir, Theodore Roosevelt, Frederick Jackson Turner. They're all of a generation. And they're fighting out to understand how Americans are going to think about wilderness. The conservation movement, which Muir initially was kind of interested in, has a utility value. You don't preserve just for the sake of it being there. It's more like recreation. Now, with Yellowstone, a huge issue about Yellowstone is the train. How close is the train going to come? How close did the train come? Livingston, which is about 50 miles, I think. They didn't let the train come in. But this issue about access becomes important. Who gets to go to the wilderness? And who doesn't get to go to the wilderness?
And now snowmobiles.
Oh, well, I'm from Minnesota. You want to talk about the boundary waters. What's most interesting about this, I'm going to stop pretty quick, but most interesting that then we come to 1910, and the Hetch Hetchy Dam, right, in Yosemite, I know some of you are from California, it's a matter of putting up a dam to get water for the city. And it's going to flood in this preserve. There's an interesting geographic phenomena related to who is in favor of the dam. The people in San Francisco were in favor of the dam. The further you get away, the more people are not in favor of the dam, right? So people on the East Coast think it's a terrible idea. They just want the wilderness. And it happens again and again and again. This matter of utility has to do with my utility. And how we work that out, it's a very difficult question. I do, then the last piece in this I want to take you to then is in the early 20th century, Aldo Leopold, and the beginning of the ecology movement. So we start to have a different understanding of human nature, right? The Calvinists, human nature is deprived, and wilderness is a danger because it will bring out sinfulness. In the Romantic period, a different view of human nature. Emerson, you know, it's all intuition, and you go out into nature, and it will draw out your appreciation for God, and, you know, that's a very positive view of human nature. In the ecology movement, where we're moving toward preservation, humans come to be seen as part of a bigger system. Part of the whole interrelatedness. And so you don't overcome nature, you live inside of nature as part of this thing that if you're a Christian, you might say God has created with some purpose. So then we might go back to the peaceful kingdom image there. I want to stop here by reading you. Oh, if I can find my little note card, here it is. From Leopold, the great summary of what happens in America. He says, this is from the Forward to Sam Camptree Almanac. Like winds and sunsets, wild things were taken for granted until progress began to do away with them. Now we face the question whether a still higher standard of living is worth its cost in things natural, wild, and free. For us of the minority, the opportunity to see geese is more important than television, and the chance to find a Pasque flower is a right as inalienable as free speech. This is written in the 40s. These wild things, I admit, had little human value until mechanization assured us of a good breakfast. So he's recognizing that to the vacationer, wilderness is a very different experience than it is to the pioneer or the settler. Until mechanization assured us of a good breakfast, and until science disclosed the drama of where they came from and how they live. So also how we understand them is different. Are those wild things really wild? I don't know if any of you have read Barbara Kingsolver's most recent novel, Prodigal Summer. It's a beautiful, lush novel. And the way she thinks about predators, you know, they don't seem so scary. Now, I think if I met a bear, I'd still be afraid, but I'd have a greater appreciation for the thing I was afraid of. The whole conflict thus boils down to a question of degree. We of the minority see a law of diminishing returns in progress, and our opponents don't. The hermit saw wilderness as ambiguous. It could be one thing or another. It could be temptation or a place of refuge and renewal. Americans have also an ambiguity, but it's a slightly different one. And I think our ambiguity has to do with, it has maybe three parts. Is it something frightening? Is it something for me to use? Or is it something on its own? Right? Those are the three pieces of our layers, mm-hmm. our layers of wilderness. Next time we'll talk about a different kind of pilgrim that goes to the wilderness saying it gives us access to God. We have about 5 or 10 minutes. I'm glad some people talked as we went along. You may have responses. I hope what this does is help you be able to sort out your own responses. And when you read in the newspaper, like I do, about the boundary waters, I can say, oh, I see. You know, that's partly what's going on there. So, responses, yeah.
And having grown up reading Laura Ingalls Wilder, Science in the Earth, it's a whole different deal.
Yeah. Oh, because that's much more romanticized, isn't it? Yeah. And it's not that far away. We have a lake place. We drive through past from our house to it, past several of the Laura Ingalls Wilder stopping points, and it's not that much further to South Dakota. But no American tradition and no Christian tradition is single. That's really important to keep in mind. Yeah, Rick.
Well, your focus has been on our view of wilderness, but there's also the view of us.
Yeah.
In relation to wilderness.
Yeah. And you picked up on that. Good.
You've talked through. And the one you've left out is the sort of radical ecology movement, Earth First kind of thing.
Yeah.
Where in some ways it sounds very Calvinistic.
Yeah.
In the sense, you know, we're the problem.
Yeah.
You know, now it's from a different place, but you know, we're the ones who are out of sync with God.
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful kind of connection to make, both the similarity and the difference. Mm-hmm. Because in the Calvinist one, we're the problem, but so is the wilderness.
So is the wilderness, right.
And in that radical Earth First, we're the problem. And if we would just get in line with nature,
right.
Then Eden and paradise would be restored.
Right.
And I think Jonathan Edwards or, you know, Pacoimus, they would say, no. Excuse me, we are not going to restore paradise ourselves just by getting...
With nature.
Right. And when we look tomorrow at these people who are interested in sacred place and nature, I also want to talk about this two books that's a long-standing tradition in Christianity where you have the book, the revealed book of the Bible, and the book of nature. And what does the book of nature tell us about who God is,
who we are. There's a kind of romantic view of nature, which, you know, I believe in God because of rainbows, right? But when my students do that, I always read them the piece from Pilgrim at Tinker Creek when Annie Dillard describes the giant water bug sucking the life out of the frog. You know, and now what? What do we do with this? That's the view of wilderness. That's the howling wilderness, right?